content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 6, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's juggernaut picks up speed. What happened? Donald Trump left his Republican rivals with dwindling hopes of stopping him after he swept to emphatic victories in primaries across the Eastern Seaboard this week and piled up delegates he needs for a first ballot nomination. Trump triumphed with 30-point margins in all five contests, Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island, with between 54 and 64% of the vote. Of the 118 bound delegates available, he picked up at least 109. Although the New Yorker had been expected to win handily in the Northeast, his huge margin of victory was a humiliating blow for Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Ohio Governor John Kasich, who had earlier announced an agreement to cede some key states to each other in order to deny Trump delegates and force a contested convention. With only 10 contests remaining and 1,237 needed to win, Trump has at least 949 delegates, Cruz 544, and Kasich 153. "I consider myself the presumptive nominee, absolutely," Trump said. "As far as I'm concerned, it's over." In an unorthodox effort to change the narrative of his faltering campaign, Cruz announced that former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina, who dropped out of the presidential race earlier this year, would serve as his running mate. Earlier, Cruz and Kasich agreed to stop campaigning in each other's strongest states. Kasich has pulled out of Indiana, which votes next week and is seen as Cruz's best shot for a victory. In return, Cruz is no longer campaigning in Oregon or New Mexico, states Kasich hopes to win. Trump blasted his Republican opponents for their collusion and trained his sights on Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton. He claimed the former Secretary of State's only qualification for the presidency is the women's card, adding, "Frankly, if Hillary Clinton were a man, I don't think she would get 5% of the vote." But in a sign the bellicose billionaire wants to project a more presidential image, Trump made a rare scripted speech in which he laid out his foreign policy, vowing to reverse what he called the weakness, confusion, and disarray of the Obama administration. He pledged to avoid nation building in the Middle East, stay out of international agreements, and put America first. What the editorial said. Trump's opponents are running out of states to stop him, said the Wall Street Journal. More alarmingly, the frontrunner's support no longer is contained below 40% as more Republicans embrace his candidacy. In Pennsylvania, he trounced his opponents in every demographic with 56% of the vote. Cruz, meanwhile, is finding it increasingly hard to win voters outside his deeply conservative evangelical base. Tuesday's primary in Indiana is now a do-or-die showdown between the two. The non-aggression pact between Cruz and Kasich is a cynical gamble, said the Dallas Morning News. Yes, it could help deny Trump victory in Indiana, where his poll lead over Cruz is slim, but it could lend credence to Trump's claim that the primaries are rigged and harden the anti-establishment fervor that's fueling the Trump juggernaut. What the columnist said. Cruz's appointment of a running mate is a desperate move, said Andrew Prokop in Vox.com. His choice is fairly sound. Fiorina won a Republican Senate primary in delegate-rich California back in 2010 and cut Trump down to size during a September debate. But vice presidential picks usually have little effect, and Fiorina has shown little ability to actually win votes. Cruz will need more than this to reinvigorate his campaign, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. The Texas senator has made it perfectly clear why Republicans shouldn't vote for Trump, but he has never presented his own vision for the presidency, other than some standard conservative rhetoric and vague attacks on Washington. You cannot beat something with nothing. Trump is doing something he hasn't done before, said Jim Newell in Slate.com. In all five states that voted on Tuesday, he did significantly better than polls had predicted. It's hard to know why. Perhaps his recent howling over what he says is a rigged nomination process is resonating with voters. But if he can continue surpassing expectations, particularly in Indiana and California, then he's the nominee. Prepare for the mom versus dad election, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. Trump supporters see their man as a father figure, a big, tough guy who will protect them, find them a job, and generally solve all of life's problems. 8 years ago, liberals expected similar magic out of Barack Obama, but he failed to bridge our divisions and heal the planet. Trump supporters will also be deeply disappointed. The funny thing is, Trump voters really think he can win in November, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. They shrug off the poll showing that 70% of women, 87% of Hispanics, and 67% of all Americans view Trump unfavorably, reasoning that every prediction from the so-called knowledge pundit class was wrong. But Trump can't take it to Clinton the way he demeaned Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. In attacking her as an unqualified woman, as he did this week, Trump will play right into her victim narrative and confirm the widespread perception he's a crude, sexist bully. A Trump victory in November is not impossible, but it will take some kind of paradigm-shifting event for it to occur. And a second main story. Surging Clinton turns her focus to Trump. What happened? Hillary Clinton began pivoting toward the general election and asking for Democratic unity against Donald Trump this week after amassing a prohibitive delegate lead over Senator Bernie Sanders with victories in 4 out of 5 Eastern primaries. Clinton decisively defeated her insurgent rival in Pennsylvania, winning 56% of the vote to Sanders' 44%, and crushed him in Maryland, 63-33, and Delaware, 60-39. In Connecticut, Clinton scored a 52-46 win. The Vermont senator's lone bright spot was Rhode Island, the only primary open to independents, where he secured 55% of the vote to Clinton's 43%. Clinton now has 1,650 pledged delegates to Sanders' 1,348, with 2,383 required for the nomination. With superdelegates, party leaders who can back any candidate regardless of how their own state votes, her advantage grows to 2,170 to 1,387. In her victory speech, the former Secretary of State aims squarely at likely Republican nominee Donald Trump. Despite what other candidates say, she said, "We believe in the goodness of our people and the greatness of our nation." Sanders appeared to accept that victory was now nearly impossible. He vowed to carry his campaign to July's convention in Philadelphia and fight for a progressive party platform, but made no mention of winning the nomination. He has said his potential support of Clinton depends on whether she will stand up to big money interests, including Wall Street and pharmaceutical and energy companies. Clinton countered this week that she had worked hard to elect then-Senator Barack Obama after their bitter 2008 nomination fight and did not put down conditions. What the editorial said. "It's time for the Democrats to rally around their nominee," said the Baltimore Sun. When the campaign started, few people could have imagined that Clinton would have to expend so much energy fending off a challenge from a feisty 74-year-old self-declared Democratic socialist. Sanders has injected an unexpected element of excitement into the race. But now that Clinton has all but bested the Vermont senator, she must focus on Trump and the general election, and so should her party. Clinton must learn from the rise of Trump and Sanders, said the New York Times. Both men have tapped into the frustrations of working and middle-class voters who feel forgotten by Washington elites, beholden to special interests. Democrats like to think of themselves as champions of the poor, unemployed, and indebted. Yet the party has failed to advance meaningful legislation on college affordability, the minimum wage, or veterans care. It's left voters disillusioned, and if Clinton can't inspire and rally them, someone else will. What the columnist said, Sanders can't win, but he's right to battle on, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. His message resonates powerfully with the young liberals who represent the future of the party, and by taking his fight to the convention and supporting down-ballot progressive candidates, Sanders can build a real political movement. But he'll squander his leverage if he doesn't stick to issues and stop attacking Clinton, the party's standard bearer. He will have to act like a loyal Democrat, an uneasy posture for a lifelong gadfly. But it's worth the price. Clinton should resist the temptation to move left in an attempt to win over Sanders supporters, said Alan Dershowitz in the Boston Globe. The senator and his radical followers want to upend the table and usher in revolutionary structural changes in banking, education, and military, and other institutions. But the mainstream swing voters who usually decide national elections want stability, predictability, and gradual improvements. Clinton had better remember that and pretend Sanders had never entered the race. Otherwise, she may get burned. For all her experience and tenacity, Clinton is a cautious, uninspiring candidate with plenty of troubling baggage, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. But if the ignorant, unprepared, proto-fascist Trump wins the Republican nomination, millions of GOP voters may well consider crossing party lines for the first time in their lives. Clinton will still have to earn their votes by clearly articulating how her vision differs from President Obama's and by displaying the candor, honesty, and openness Americans expect from their commander-in-chief. For that reason, they better hope she turns out to be more visionary, more courageous, and more honest than they ever imagined. Our controversy of the week, Tubman. Is it politically correct to put her on the $20 bill? This might be the most popular decision of the Obama presidency, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. After much deliberation, Treasury Secretary Jack Lew announced last week that a portrait of the abolitionist icon Harriet Tubman will replace that of President Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill. Liberals are obviously delighted to see the slave-owning Jackson, who set in motion the bloody ethnic cleansing of Native Americans along the Trail of Tears, replaced with a deserving African-American woman. Republicans can celebrate the fact that Tubman happens to have been a gun-toting, freedom-loving Christian and Republican. Not every conservative is happy, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon.com. In fact, many right-wing pundits are in meltdown over the decision. GOP frontrunner Donald Trump echoed their argument when he called Lew's decision to supplant Jackson an act of pure political correctness, suggesting that Tubman's image should instead be banished to the exotic, rarely used $2 bill. Liberals are often mocked for their identity politics. But what does it say about the conservatives' fragile sense of self that they still insist our money be reserved for white men only? This is affirmative action raised to fanaticism, said Patrick Buchanan in RealClearPolitics.com. Yes, Andrew Jackson owned slaves, as did George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. and he was responsible for the Trail of Tears, just as Harry Truman was responsible for Hiroshima. Great men are rarely good men, and Jackson's greatness literally shaped our nation. He led U.S. troops to their historic victory over the British at the Battle of New Orleans in the War of 1812, and was twice elected president, the second time on a platform of anti-banker economic populism that would thrill progressives today. I can see why the left wants to put minorities and women on currency, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. But creating a zero-sum game in which a historic male figure must be trashed and banished is a sad commentary on a nation that no longer honors its history. Is it political correctness and historical revisionism to put Tubman's defiant likeness on the $20 bill? Asked Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Of course, and high time, too. Ours is no longer a nation where glory is reserved for white men only, and there is no more deserving non-white, non-male icon than Tubman. Born a slave in Maryland, she escaped from her captors, famously using the North Star to find her way to Pennsylvania, then risked her life on dozens of trips back south, helping countless other slaves find freedom along the Underground Railroad. Tubman, however, won't have the $20 bill all to herself, said Alicia Adamczyk in Time.com. A smaller image of Jackson will appear on the back of the redesigned $20 bill, so it will have an escaped slave on front, a slave owner on the back. Does that seem a bit tone-deaf to anyone? Tubman and Jackson would probably be uncomfortable sharing a bill, said Frank Daniels in the Tennessean, especially since Jackson hated paper money of any kind. But such is the grubby complexity of America. If we reduce our checkered history to simplistic one-dimensional stories, we lose who we are. Tubman should not be viewed merely as a hero for African Americans and women, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. Slavery was a violation of the deep truth of the natural rights that undergird the American experiment. And prior to her escape, Tubman remembered thinking that she would be satisfied only by death or liberty. Is it possible to utter a more American sentiment? Harriet Tubman belongs to all of us. Well, it was a good week for self-defense. After the entire police force, one marshal and three volunteer deputies of Green Mountain Falls, Colorado, abruptly resigned. Newly elected Mayor Jane Newberry suggested that for now the town's 700 residents all look out for each other. It was a good week for the wisdom of the ages after archaeologists uncovered a 2,400-year-old tile in Turkey depicting a reclining skeleton next to a jug of wine, alongside the words, "Be cheerful, enjoy your life." And it was a good week for runner's high after British astronaut Tim Peake completed his own version of the London Marathon while tethered to a treadmill aboard the International Space Station. Peake completed his 26.2-mile run in 3 hours, 35 minutes. But it was a bad week for jumping out of the frying pan after an alleged robber tried to flee a Washington, D.C. crime scene by climbing over the White House security fence. Secret Service agents quickly grabbed him. It was a bad week for empathy after Norwegian Immigration Minister Sylvi Listhaug attempted to experience the plight of Syrian migrants by jumping into the Mediterranean Sea while wearing a survival suit. Next week, one critic tweeted, "Sylvi Listhaug experienced what it's like to be blind by closing her eyes." And it was a bad week for radical acceptance after ISIS reportedly opened a relationship counseling center in Raqqa, Syria, because so many women who married the group's fighters are fleeing. At least before ISIS, we had electricity. We could bake and cook, said one disenchanted bride. Now we are back to ancient times. We're on the briefing page now. The war against ISIS. ISIS is losing battles, territory, and money in Iraq and Syria, while still expanding elsewhere. Can it be stopped? How is the war going? The U.S. and its allies are riding a wave of successes. In the past few months, Iraqi forces backed by American airstrikes have liberated the city of Ramadi, while Kurdish Peshmerga and Yazidi fighters have retaken several northern towns. The Pentagon says it has killed about 26,000 ISIS fighters altogether, cut into the group's cash flow, and driven the terrorists out of 40% of the land the organization once controlled. The population living under ISIS's brutal reign has dropped from 9 million to 6 million people. U.S. strikes have killed several top ISIS strategists, and there are reports that ISIS fighters are retreating wherever they're attacked, rather than fighting as fiercely as they once did. We have momentum, President Obama said, and we intend to keep that momentum. His administration has announced it's launched a cyber war against ISIS and is sending more troops and arms, including American-operated Apache attack helicopters, to help Iraqi forces retake Mosul, ISIS's Iraqi headquarters, later this year. About 250 U.S. military personnel are also being sent to Syria to help coordinate the Sunni tribes battling ISIS there. How many American troops are in Iraq? The official cap is just over 4,000 troops, there to advise and train Iraqi forces. But Pentagon officials said the true number is closer to 5,000 at any given time, if you take into account soldiers on temporary assignments and those rotating in to relieve others. A large Marine force of three amphibious warships with an additional 4,500 personnel was also just deployed to the Persian Gulf. It's far from the 150,000 American troops in Iraq during the 2003 to 2011 war, but a significant escalation of the 275 troops Obama sent in June 2014. And U.S. soldiers are starting to get more involved. The Pentagon announced last week that U.S. advisors will now embed with Iraqi brigades, putting them close to the fighting. Why the change? After coming under heavy criticism for limiting U.S. involvement, the president seems determined to make demonstrable progress against ISIS before his term ends. U.S. troops are still theoretically not authorized to initiate direct combat, but that distinction is getting increasingly blurry in the stepped-up campaign. U.S. Special Operations Forces have used raids and airstrikes to target what the Pentagon calls ISIS's cabinet, assassinating the group's finance minister, war minister, and other top officials. U.S. air power has been pounding ISIS in Iraq and Syria, dropping more than 11,000 bombs from November through February. Much of that barrage targeted the oil fields and buildings believed to store ISIS's cash. Is ISIS now hurting for funds? The losses of oil fields and territory have taken a toll. Last year, ISIS was raking in some $80 million a month from oil smuggling, antiquities sales, and taxes. That revenue has now been cut by about 30%. U.S. intelligence sources say. ISIS is reportedly paying its fighters half what they once made and rationing medical supplies. But ISIS is still the best-funded militant group in the world. Its leaders continue to sell oil, have piles of cash plundered from Iraqi banks, and heavily tax citizens in the areas of Syria and Iraq under their control. How much is Iraq helping? The Iraqi army is more professional than it once was, but it is still hampered by the country's political dysfunction. The Shiite-dominated government of Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi has been inept and corrupt, criticized even by fellow Shiites. Radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr recently led thousands of followers in a sit-in at the gates of Baghdad's Green Zone until al-Abadi agreed to fire many of his top cabinet ministers. Preoccupied by infighting, the government has failed to do any real outreach to the disgruntled Sunni tribes who have been marginalized ever since Saddam Hussein was toppled in 2003. These angry Sunnis remain ripe for recruitment by extremists. ISIS could be defeated tomorrow, wrote military analyst Max Boot, and we will simply see a successor organization arise unless Sunni political grievances are addressed. Meanwhile, ISIS is seeding its fanatical end times ideology throughout the Muslim world like a cancerous tumor that's metastasizing. Where is the group spreading? ISIS affiliates have sprung up in Algeria and Sudan and as far away as Pakistan and the Philippines. But the group's main focus outside the Levant is its new stronghold in Libya, where it controls the coastal city of Sirte. Right now, it has about 6,000 fighters there, including experienced militants sent by ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi to run the group. And they're fighting to take control of the oil fields of the Sirte Basin, the center of Libya's oil industry. At the same time, ISIS's sophisticated propaganda arm continues to use the internet and local sympathizers to recruit Westerners as jihadists, encouraging them to carry out attacks in their home countries. Belgian officials said last week they had evidence that ISIS had just sent a new wave of militants to Europe to conduct terrorist attacks. You can defeat ISIS in ISIS-controlled territories, but you're not going to defeat ISIS itself, said analyst Jonathan Schantzer of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. The ideology of jihadism continues to evolve. It's time for a few columns. We'll start with one from the U.S. Why we're stuck with the Saudis. Saudi Arabia and the U.S. are trapped in a bad marriage, said Aaron David Miller. The broken state of the relationship was vividly illustrated last week when President Obama arrived in Riyadh for a state visit and was snubbed by King Salman, who sent a lower-level official to greet him at the airport. Obama claimed he and Salman had a frank discussion about their differences, but the reality is that our countries have different values, and our once common interests are diverging. Saudi Arabia is an authoritarian regime that exports a fundamentalist Wahhabist ideology that demonizes Shiites, Jews, Christians, and the West. There is evidence that some of its officials may have provided support to the 9/11 hijackers, and relatives of 9/11 victims are now pressing for the right to sue the kingdom. But as bad as things are, the U.S.-Saudi relationship is too big to fail. The Saudis need our military support, and Washington still needs the Saudis for intelligence sharing and operations against ISIS and al-Qaeda affiliates. The collapse of their regime would cause unthinkable chaos that terrorists would surely exploit. So both sides have no choice but to manage this unhappy marriage. Neither divorce nor reconciliation is likely. And this from Saudi Arabia, giving up on U.S. support. Saudi Arabia is fed up with America, said Bernard Haykel. President Obama visited Riyadh last week in a bid to revive the two countries' ailing alliance, but it wasn't enough. The Saudis have felt betrayed ever since Obama lifted sanctions against Tehran in exchange for Iran curtailing its nuclear program. Obama hoped this diplomatic outreach would lead Iran to become a more responsible state actor. But his strategy is failing. Shiite Iran is the principal backer of the Syrian and Iraqi regimes, making it a leading contributor to the humanitarian tragedy in both countries, where Sunni Arabs comprise the majority of the victims of violence. As the leader of the Sunni Muslim world, Saudi Arabia can't sit by. Convinced that the Obama administration no longer has its back, it has been forced to end its tradition of behind-the-scenes maneuvers and go on the offensive, fighting against Iran-backed militias in Yemen and severing diplomatic relations with Iran itself. If the U.S. wants to make things right, it should offer the Saudis an explicit promise to defend them against the all-external aggression. It should also lead a mediation effort to end the wars in Syria and Iraq. Without U.S. political leadership now, U.S. military intervention later will become a near certainty. And from Austria, going to extremes of left and right. The center has collapsed in Austrian politics. Make way for the fringes, said Rainer Nowak. Norbert Hofer, a far-right populist from the anti-Islam, anti-immigration Freedom Party, won the first round of the presidential election this week with 36% of the vote. In the runoff next month, he will face the far-left Green Party candidate, Alexander Van der Bellen, who placed a distant second with 20%. The results are a huge blow for the two parties that have dominated Austrian politics since the end of World War II and currently rule together in a coalition, the center-right People's Party and the center-left Social Democrats. This will be the first time since 1945 that the president will not come from one of those parties, and the shock, bitterness, and embarrassment of it all is overwhelming. The upheaval has made clear that our old stable era is at an end. Like so many of their fellow Europeans, Austrians are bitterly divided over the migrant crisis racking the continent and are furious at their current leaders, whom they see as out of touch with the fast-changing world. Will they choose the gun-toting Hofer, 45, who says Austrians should arm themselves against migrants? Or Van der Bellen, 72, a child of Estonian refugees who is staunchly pro-immigration? What comes next is anyone's guess. And we're on to the last word, our in-depth article, this week titled, White Women Dying Young. Why are so many working-class women in rural America dying in middle age, asked journalist Eli Saslow. Addiction, suicide, and an epidemic of despair. They had been expecting a full processional with a limousine and a police escort, but the limousine never came and the police officer was called away to a suspected drug overdose at the last minute. That left 40 friends and relatives of Anna Marie Jones stranded outside the funeral home, waiting for instructions from the mortician about what to do next. An uncle of Anna's went to his truck and changed from khakis into overalls. A niece ducked behind the hearse to light her cigarette in the stiff Oklahoma wind. Just one more thing for Mom that didn't go as planned, said Tiffany Edwards, the youngest surviving daughter. She climbed into her truck, put on the flashers, and motioned for everyone else to follow her behind her in their own cars. They formed a makeshift processional of dented pickups and diesel exhausts, driving out of town onto dirt roads and up to a tiny cemetery bordered by the cattle grazing fields. In the back, there was a fresh plot marked by a plastic sign. Anna Marie Jones, born 1961, died 2016. 54 years old. Raised on 3 rural acres, high school educated, a mother of 3, local employee of Kmart, Walls Bargain Center, and Dollar Store. These were the facts of her life as printed in the funeral program, and now they had also become clues in an American crisis with implications far beyond the burnt grass and red dirt of central Oklahoma. White women between 25 and 55 have been dying at accelerating rates over the past decade, a spike in mortality not seen since the AIDS epidemic in the early 1980s. According to recent studies of death certificates, the trend is worse for women in the center of the United States, worse still in rural areas, and worst of all for those in the lower middle class. Drug and alcohol overdose rates for working-age white women have quadrupled. Suicides are up by as much as 50%. What killed Jones was cirrhosis of the liver brought on by heavy drinking. The exact culprit was vodka, whatever brand was on sale, poured into a pint glass 8 ounces at a time. But as Anna's family gathered at the gravesite, they wondered instead about the root causes, which were harder to diagnose and more difficult to solve. Life didn't always break her way. She dealt with that sadness, said Candy Payne, the funeral officiant. She tried her best. She loved her family, but she dabbled in the drinking, and when things got tough, the drinking made it harder. There were plots nearby marked for Jones' friends and relatives who had died in the past decade at ages 46, 52, and 37. Jones had buried her fiancé dead at 55. She had eulogized her best friend dead at 50 from alcohol-induced cirrhosis. Other parts of the adjacent land were intended for her children. Davy, 38, her oldest son and most loyal caretaker, who was making it through the day with some of his mother's vodka. Mary Ann, 33, the middle-aged daughter, who had hitched a ride to the service because she couldn't afford a working car. And Tiffany, 31, who had 2 daughters of her own, a job at the discount grocery, and enough accumulated stress to make her feel at least a decade or two older, she said. Candy, who in addition to being the officiant was also a close family friend, motioned for Tiffany and Marianne to bring over the container holding their mother's cremated remains. They opened the lid and the ashes blew back into their dresses and out into the pasture. All anyone else had so far was a question, one that has also become the focal point of congressional hearings, health summits, and presidential debates. Why? Why, after 50 years of progress in life expectancy for every conceivable group of Americans, men, women, young, old, rich, poor, high school dropouts, college graduates, rural, urban, white, black, Hispanic, or Asian, has one demographic group in the past decade experienced a significant percent increase in premature deaths? Why were so many white women reporting precipitous drops in physical health, mental health, comfort, and mobility during their working age prime? Why, over the past 8 years alone, had more than 300,000 of these women essentially chosen to poison themselves? It's a loss of hope, a loss of expectations of progress from one generation to the next, said Angus Deaton, a Nobel Prize-winning economist who had studied the data. What we're seeing is the strain of inequality on the middle class, President Obama said. Erosion of the safety net, Hillary Clinton said. Depression caused by the state of our country, Donald Trump said. Isolated rural communities, Bernie Sanders said. addictive pain pills and narcotics, Marco Rubio said. There were so many paths in the America of 2016 to what coroners termed a premature and unnatural death. And one version was what had happened to Jones. Another night of drinking that ended in the emergency room, her seventh trip in the past 4 years, a diagnosis of end-stage liver failure, a week in a nursing home, a quiet death followed by a burial 4 days later. She had been born on the way to the hospital in the back seat of her father's car, the ninth of 10 children, and the family joke was that Anna had never stopped hurtling her way into the world. At a time when life on the far edges of the middle class came with dependable opportunities, her older siblings left home for the quarry, the machine shop, and the military. And Anna moved out along with them, even though she was only 17. She rushed off to get married in Reno, Nevada. She got a job at a Kmart snack bar in California and worked her way up to manager. She was good at making people feel comfortable, at listening without judgment, and aligning herself with the customer. She clipped coupons for regulars and gave them free drinks to people who couldn't afford them. By the time she reached her mid-20s, Kmart was training her to become a regional manager. She had her own trailer in Ferndale, California, 2 children, 2 cars, and a retirement savings account. But the promotion never materialized, and the marriage took work, and after a while, her eagerness turned to restlessness. She drank more. She tried drugs. She left Kmart. She was arrested for drinking and for failing to pay her taxes. Her marriage unraveled, and she moved home to Oklahoma with the kids. She helped push Marianne and Tiffany to finish high school, and then, once all of her children left home, she lived for a while with her mother, then her daughter, then her fiancé, and finally her son for the last years of her life. Sometimes the hard things in life eventually break you, said Caitlin, Anna's friend. Tiffany drove home to a trailer where everyone was waiting for her and where all of them needed something. Her 4-year-old daughter wanted dinner. Her disabled 1-year-old daughter had another doctor's appointment in Oklahoma City. Her husband, Chad, needed their car to run errands. Her boss missed her at work. Her brother needed money for rent. And then there was their trailer itself, which they had purchased for $2,000 from a cousin because they wanted to tear it down and put a new trailer on their beautiful country lot. But now it was 2 years later, and they were still in the old trailer with faulty electricity, a broken shower, and no door for the bathroom. A work in progress, Tiffany called it, and sometimes she thought that was true of so many lives in this part of Oklahoma. Goals receded into the distance while reality stretched on for day after day after exhausting day, until it was only natural to desire a little something beyond yourself. Maybe it was just some mindless TV or time on Facebook. Maybe a sleeping pill to ease you through the night. Maybe a prescription narcotic to numb the physical and psychological pain, or a trip to the Indian casino that you couldn't really afford, or some marijuana or meth or the drug that had run strongest on both sides of her family for 3 generations and counting. Shot and a beer for Mom, she said now, raising a shot glass to her husband. He shook his head. She drank the shot and sat down next to him in the living room. They had gotten drunk with her mother dozens of times, and it was almost always fun. She was a happy drinker who made for good company around a fire with fun stories and a throaty laugh. After she was diagnosed with cirrhosis in 2009, doctors had said her prognosis was good if she stopped drinking. Her liver had a few years left. She would be eligible for a transplant. And for a few months at a time, she had managed to quit. But reality often left her depressed. Her fiancé died. A few nephews were arrested for using drugs. She filed for bankruptcy. Her mother died. She drank until she was too sick to work. I could be mean to her sometimes, Tiffany said now in the living room. I kept saying to her, "You're killing yourself." You were just trying to pull her out of the spiral, Chad said. They each had gone through spirals of their own. Chad had been arrested for driving under the influence 3 times in the years after his own mother's death before straightening himself out to take care of the children. Tiffany had sometimes been going to work, hungover, until she became pregnant, and then she went 9 months without a beer or a cigarette. I'm not going to make my problems my kids' problems, she had told her mother then, because there was still hope that her children would have it easier. Don't you want to see what your grandchildren become? Tiffany would ask. Don't you want to be there for them? But even though Anna loved her granddaughters, babysat them, admired the way Tiffany and Chad cared for them, bought them whatever she could never give them that. She quit drinking and then started again, quit and then again, then started. She fell down at her house and broke a leg. She had to use a wheelchair. She lost her car and then her driver's license. She stayed in her living room and watched TV for hours at a time unless Tiffany came to pick her up. She had family. She had friends, Tiffany said. I don't understand why it wasn't enough. With Anna gone, it was now just Davy left in their home, with bed sheets blocking the windows. His mother's medications were still stacked on the counter. Those were her clothes, strewn across the living room, her microwaved jambalaya leftovers in the sink, and her $8.75 a liter of Heaven Hill vodka pushed against the couch. Davy reached for the bottle and took a gulp. He chased it with water and then drank again. Last day, he said. Tomorrow it's detox, getting a job, all that. The day before, he had also been the last day, and so had the weekend before that. And now it was 2 weeks until $350 in rent came due on the house. He had no money of his own and nowhere else to go. For the past 5 years, he had been living with his mother and surviving on her disability payments and $197 in food stamps. She had supported him, and he had been her caretaker, lifting her out of bed in the mornings and pushing her wheelchair up the hill to a tornado shelter whenever a storm hit. He had monitored her medications, washed her jaundiced skin, and dealt with the diapers. He had even tried to keep her from drinking, just as the doctors insisted. But he was buying vodka with her money and drinking it in front of her, and she would yell and beg and then threaten to withhold Davy's cash so he couldn't drink either. Eventually, he had decided to compromise by rationing out her liquor. But sometimes he would pass out on the couch or go to the bathroom, and whenever he came back, the bottle looked emptier than before. "Do you blame me?" he asked Tiffany a day after the funeral. "You did the best you could," Tiffany told him. "There's no sense in obsessing over it." Davy sipped from the bottle. He lay back on the couch, where lately he had been having a recurring dream. He was sitting in the living room with his mother, a woman not yet 55 who had some color back in her cheeks and her hair in a braid. He wanted to be honest with her to tell her she was dying, and finally he blurted it out. "You're dying," he said, but she didn't look back at him. "You're dying," he said again. "You're dying." But the TV was blaring. The bottle was in her hands. Her eyes were glazed over, and she was too far gone to hear him. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. On the obituary page, we have the musical chameleon who defied definition. Prince, 1958 to 2016. At the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction ceremony in 2004, a group of legendary rockers paid tribute to the late George Harrison with a cover of the Beatles' While My Guitar Gently Weeps. Tom Petty, Steve Winwood, Jeff Lynne, and Harrison's son, Donnie, strummed through a few tastefully respectful verses. Then Prince appeared on stage and outshone and outplayed them all. Sporting a bright red hat and matching shirt unbuttoned to his stomach, he delivered a blistering guitar solo, threw the instrument over his head, turned on his heel, and walked off stage without saying a word. Prince, who was found dead last week at his Paisley Park home studio outside Minneapolis, was the consummate performer. The genre-spanning musician sold more than 100 million records over his four-decade career, shifting seamlessly from R&B to soul and hard rock, from funk and jazz to pop. He could switch from a piercing falsetto to a lush baritone to a roaring gospel shout. In concert, the 5-foot-2-inch Prince combined James Brown's footwork with classic rock star posturing. He pushed sexual boundaries, defied racial and sexual categorization, and even gave up his own name to assert his creative autonomy. "When I first started out in the music industry, I was most concerned with freedom," he said. "Freedom to produce, freedom to play all the instruments on my records, freedom to say anything I wanted to." Born in Minneapolis, Prince Rogers Nelson had music in his blood, said the Associated Press. His father played piano in a jazz band. His mother was the group singer. The precocious young Prince taught himself to play the piano at age 7, the guitar at age 13, and the drums at 14. He formed his first group in high school and at 19 signed a record deal with Warner Brothers. Prince's debut album, 1978's For You, received mixed reviews, but demonstrated that he could do anything. He wrote and sang the material and served as his own one-man band on guitar, bass, drums, synthesizer, chimes, and assorted other instruments. It was with his second self-titled album that Prince's career began to explode, said the Los Angeles Times. The infectious singles I Want to Be Your Lover and Why You Want to Treat Me So Bad drove the album to platinum sales. He followed up. His follow-up, 1980's Dirty Mind, saw Prince move from typical R&B romance to raunchier, more graphic scenarios. Yet his most explicit tracks were always rooted in a tender, sometimes mystical spirituality that made even his bawdiest lyrics feel generous. And with his singular fashion style, ubiquitous purple, frilled garments, lavish makeup, and high heels, he was matched only by David Bowie for his appeal across all sexualities. Prince didn't let formats or categories confine him, said the New York Times. In the title track of his fourth album, Controversy, he said, "Am I black or am I white? Am I straight or gay?" His star continued to rise with 1999, a double LP that included the hit single Little Red Corvette, one of the first songs by a black musician to be played in heavy rotation on MTV. In 1984, he sealed his transformation from stardom to superstardom with his Oscar-winning soundtrack to the semi-autobiographical film Purple Rain, which starred Prince as an aspiring rock star escaping an abusive family. With number one hits in Let's Go Crazy and When Doves Cry, he at one point had the number one album, single, and film simultaneously. Not everyone was a fan. When Tipper Gore, wife of then-Senator Al Gore, caught her 11-year-old daughter listening to Darling Nikki, a song on Purple Rain that references female masturbation, she was so outraged that she began lobbying record labels to slap parental advisory stickers on albums with explicit lyrics. With celebrity came the first signs of his eccentric behavior, which was not always endearing, said the Times. He was monosyllabic at award ceremonies that honored him and ended his 1985 tour by cryptically announcing that he was retiring to go and look for the ladder. Prince didn't keep his word and continued to produce music at a furious pace, ending the decade by recording the soundtrack for the 1989 film Batman and playing guitar on several songs on Madonna's album Like a Prayer. The 1990s were more fraught, said Newsweek.com. He became embroiled in bitter contractual disputes with Warner Brothers, changed his name to an unpronounceable male-female symbol, earning him the nickname The Artist formerly known as Prince, and released a series of barely marketable albums. In 1996, he married backing dancer Mate Garcia, but the couple endured heartbreak that year when their week-old son died from a rare genetic condition. They divorced in 1999. Prince escaped his recording contract the following year, reclaimed his original name, and released a pointedly titled album, Emancipation. "If you don't own your masters," he once said, "your masters owns you. Prince reemerged in his 40s as something of a changed and chastened man, said the Washington Post. He married again. It lasted only 5 years, became a Jehovah's Witness, and stopped performing his more sexually explicit work. "There's no more envelope to push," he explained. "I pushed it off the table. It's on the floor. Let's move forward now." The reclusive artist became more outgoing and began playing more live shows. He wowed audiences at the Grammy Awards with Beyoncé in 2003, said the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and was showered with praise for his Super Bowl halftime show in 2007. In recent years, friends said that Prince struggled with chronic hip pain caused by decades of performing. Only days before his death, he reportedly had to be treated for an overdose of the opioid painkiller Percocet. Yet the 57-year-old star had shown no signs of slowing down. He'd released 4 albums in the past 2 years, and last month announced he was writing an autobiography. "Sometimes I stand in awe of what I do myself," he said in 1996. "I believe definitely in the higher power that gave me this talent. If you could go in the studio alone and come out with that, you'd do it every day, wouldn't you?" And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.